She's also done work on the astrophysics of neutrinos and on space-time causal structure. She did her PhD at Perimeter Institute on the entanglement, and she did her work was largely on the entanglement entropy of scalar fields in causal set theory. She then went on to the University of Alberta for a postdoctoral fellowship, and she's recently joined Imperial College on an Imperial College research fellowship.
Thank you, Sumati, for that introduction, and thank you to the other two organizers as well. I'm going to talk about a few different lines of research that I'm involved in with the aim to understand some quantum field properties in a manifestly Lorentz invariant framework. In particular, I'll talk about vacuum states and entanglement entropy, and how their definitions can be promoted from the spatial domain in which they typically exist, so a space-time one. Around 1952, Rudolf Pyles found himself looking for a new expression of some of the basic rules of quantum mechanics, namely the formulation of the commutation laws of relativistic field theory. Now, there already existed several consistent formulations of relativistic quantum field theory at the time, for example, developed decades earlier by people like Heisenberg and Pauli, and more recent interaction picture formulations by people like Schwinger and Tomonaga and others. But despite this, Pyles was worried about the Lorentz invariance of these formulations. And he wanted to find an alternative approach in which the Lorentz invariance of the formulation was manifestly evident. He succeeded in doing this, and you can read more about it here. And in his covariant formulation of a relativistic quantum field theory, he had a general rule for the commutator at a pair of space-time points. And this space-time commutator only used Green functions of the theory and made no reference to Hamiltonian. So this I delta over here explicitly is the space-time commutator or the Pyles bracket. And you can write it as the difference between the retarded and the advanced Green function. Now, Pyles held a lot of correspondence with his colleagues about all of his works, including this one when he completed it. And a lot of the prominent physicists at the time were very much interested in this new formulation of quantum field theory. And a lot of them were also very skeptical about it, including Pauli himself. But nevertheless, this Pyles bracket and space-time commutator formulation of quantum field theory has survived as an important framework for quantum field theory that importantly illustrates that time dependence can be captured in a Lorentz invariant manner. And it has enabled progress in fields such as algebraic quantum field theory and causal set theory, which I'll talk a bit about. So the work that I'm going to talk about is in the same spirit as the work of Pyles. I will review causal set theory. I will talk about an observer-independent definition of a vacuum state called the Sorkin-Johnston vacuum state. I will talk about a space-time definition of entanglement entropy using the space-time two-point correlation function. And both of these definitions for the vacuum state and the entanglement entropy are equally applicable to continuum space-times and discrete causal sets. But I will mainly talk about them in the context of discrete causal sets, because it's more appropriate for the topic of this workshop, and because we have a covariant cutoff more naturally available to us in the discrete causal set. So we've already heard a bit about causal sets today and yesterday and some of their properties, but let me give them another introduction and remind you about some of the things that have been said. So causal set theory is an approach to quantum gravity where the deep structure of space-time is discrete and the causal relations among those discrete elements is fundamental. Formally, it's a locally finite, partially ordered set. So the set of elements are the discrete set of space-time elements, and the partial order is the causal precedence relation among them. And together, they satisfy a set of rules, for example, reflexivity, so every point precedes or is equal to itself. Antisymmetry, so if x precedes or is equal to y and y precedes or is equal to x, then x and y must be equal. This condition is to get rid of closed causal loops. We have transitivity and local finiteness. So the intersection of the set of the future of an earlier point and the past of a later point contains a finite number of elements. We are still figuring out the fundamental dynamics that will give rise to one causal set over another. Raphael talked a bit about this, what the quantum dynamics might look like. But meanwhile, a practical way we have to generate and study a causal set is through a process called sprinkling. So the way sprinkling works is we can generate a causal set from a given Lorentzian manifold by placing points uniformly at random via Poisson process at a fixed density rho such that the distribution of points in a volume of spacetime V follows this distribution. And here's just an example of a sprinkling into a two-dimensional causal diamond in Minkowski spacetime. Unlike a regular lattice, the points are randomly distributed. So if you boost this discrete structure, locally the distribution of points is going to look more or less the same random, which is unlike a regular lattice, which if you boosted it, you would get voids and overdense regions forming. So this is the sense in which it's locally Lorentz invariant. Now, we would like to study quantum fields on these causal sets, and everything I'll talk about will be in the context of quantum field theory on a background causal set, so we are ignoring any back reaction between the space-time or causal set and the quantum field. Quantum field theory can be typically fully determined by the set of its endpoint functions. So if we assume the one-point function vanishes, we have the two-point function, phi x1, phi x2, all the way to phi x1, phi x2, to phi xn, where the x's are space-time points. And these correlation functions are quantifying the strength of correlation of the field values at these different space-time points. Now, if we restrict to a free and Gaussian theory for simplicity, for example, let me take a Gaussian scalar field theory, then we only need to know the two-point function of the theory to know everything about the field. All the higher endpoint functions, one can deduce from the two-point function. So we only need expectation value of phi x1, phi x2. And this two-point function is usually called the Whiteman function, which is why we usually express it with a W. And so if we're interested in studying a Gaussian scalar field theory on this causal set, all we have to do is find W, and the rest will follow. We can find W with the help of the Pyles bracket that we saw earlier. So again, the Pyles bracket is the space-time commutator, and we can express it as the difference between the retarded and advanced Green functions. The advanced Green function is just the transpose of the retarded Green function. So really, we just need to know one or the other to know what the space-time commutator is. And in many different causal sets that are approximated by many different space-times, we know what the retarded Green function looks like. So we have an analog of this space-time commutator. Another observation that encourages us to build our quantum field theory using the space-time commutator is that the kernel of the Klein-Gordon operator is equal to the closure of the image of the commutator. So this means that the image is just whatever this delta acts on, if you think of it as an integral operator that will have a non-zero output. So this means that the eigenvectors in the image of delta span the full solution space of the Klein-Gordon operator. In most settings which we're interested in setting up our quantum field theory on the causal set, for example, in bounded regions of space-time, this I delta is a self-adjoint operator. So that means it has eigenvalues that come in positive, negative pairs and corresponding eigenfunctions or eigenvectors. And so we can expand this I delta in this basis of its positive and negative eigenvalues and corresponding eigenfunctions. And a valid choice for our Whiteman function, or W, is to restrict to the positive part of this expansion. This choice for the Whiteman function is called the Sorkin-Johnston Whiteman function, and it satisfies the two conditions that any Whiteman function needs to satisfy, which are that it be positive and its antisymmetric part gives you back the commutator. And with every choice of Whiteman function, there comes a definition of vacuum state. So the vacuum state that goes along with this Whiteman function is called the Sorkin-Johnston or SJ vacuum state. And notice the difference between this way of getting our vacuum and the canonical quantization prescription for getting a vacuum, which is typically at a moment in time. So now that we have our W, we are done. So there, like I said, everything else we want to know about the quantum field on the causal set, we can just get from this W. Now this SJ vacuum or Whiteman function has a number of interesting properties, which I'll just mention a few of them. It is defined using the entire space-time volume, so in particular both the past and the future. That's because this I delta is being diagonalized in the full space-time volume. The vacuum is an observer-independent vacuum, and the prescription leads to a unique vacuum. In static space-times, this SJ state is the same one that's picked out by the time-like and hypersurface orthogonal Hilling vector of the space-time. While the state isn't Hadamard itself necessarily, a family of Hadamard states can be constructed from it if one wishes to. And this definition of a vacuum state provides a pure state for a definition of entanglement entropy that I'm going to talk about later in this talk.
So does one know that in any given globally hyperbolic space-time, that this decomposition to the positive and negative eigenvalues is actually well-defined and drawn as well?
Right. So So in any globally hyperbolic space-time, you have a unique retarded green function. But then the other thing you need is for I delta to be self-adjoint. So
you need some Hilbert space.
So even in the in any bounded region of space-time, it's going to be self-adjoint. So in any
what is the Hilbert space?
Yeah, it means that Hilbert space out of compactly supported test sections and takes on completion.
So you can
build the Hilbert space, you still need a complex structure. You need something more than delta. Delta is just synthetic structure. That's just another way to write
synthetic structure.
Yeah, so you need a complex structure, and you don't have a complex structure in general, right? In general curved space times. I mean, static space time, space space time.
You use the L2 norm to build up.
No, you will not get the right answer in the L2 norm or space time.
Yeah, on L2 norm on space time, that's how you define these operators. These are integral operators.
No, L2 norm on, so you have the space of test functions, you can complexify it and introduce inner product where you just integrate function and the conjugate over the whole volume. So it's a choice. I mean, you have to complexify your space of test functions, but you can.
Okay, we'll talk later because it's not the main topic.
There are some results showing that this could be done from Fuster and Fesch, where they have done the functional analytic details.
Okay.
So this essay state has been studied in a number of cosmologically interesting spacetimes. For example, it's been studied in FRW spacetime, where an interesting result found was that there are correlations on superhorizon scales. So this just came out without the help of anything like inflation. So it could potentially have interesting implications for early universe cosmology and primordial perturbation theory. It's also been studied in De Sitter spacetime, mostly in the continuum in this work, and mostly in the causal set in this work, which I'll talk a little bit about in the next slide as well. So this was recent work with Sumachi and Noman. And an interesting result that we found was that these SJ states in four-dimensional De Sitter causal sets gave us a new set of De Sitter invariant vacua that are different from the usual known alpha vacua.
But we just agreed that you get a unique positive negative frequency decomposition.
Right.
And therefore you've got a unique vacuum. So why are we doing
it? It does depend on the choice of the inner product for that L2.
Yeah, that is my point. I mean, my point is that there's the.
Yes, it does depend on the inner product.
You need per choice of the inner product, but you can argue that there is some natural choice.
So on the causal set, for example, there seems to be a natural choice.
Okay, but here, for example, you get this alpha vacuum, so obviously it's not a unique choice. Different choices of inner product.
You get only one of the alpha vacuum. So the second line in the continuum calculation.
So alpha vacuum, you mean not vacuum.
Yes. One of the many corresponds to an SJ vacuum.
One. Alpha vacuum.
Yeah.
But why does sometimes be?
Sometimes I just depends on the mass of the theory. Also, in this particular work, there were calculations done in, for example, the static. Static patch and in full global De Sitter.
Okay, so the statement that there's ambiguity.
No, for a given setup, there is a unique answer.
Right, but you're given it.
For a given theory and a given space time, there's a unique answer.
No, but you said that whether I'm looking at cost thing or looking at the set.
Right, so if I give you a space time and I say the vacuum is this and this space-time. If you give me a different space-time or you say I'm only interested in the vacuum and part of it, then I can repeat this construction.
Okay.
and gives you.
And also sometimes means that in some cases, choices of mass
right.
relative to the
parameters of the theory.
When you try to take the limit of a finite region to infinity, it doesn't, it's not multiplied.
Just one special case,
that it's not multiplied.
So that special case is, it's usually said that there's no known Disseter invariant Fock vacuum for the massless minimally coupled theory. Now here are some results that we had in four dimensions. The different curves are for different masses over here. So this is the metric in conformal coordinates. T tilde goes from minus pi over 2 to pi over 2. In our causal sets, we can't simulate infinite space-time volumes, so we do our simulations for a maximum absolute value of T tilde, and we look for the convergence of our results as we take this maximum value to be closer and closer to pi over 2 in this case. So these are the converged results that I'm showing you. So we have the real part of the Whiteman function versus geodesic distance on the left for causally related pairs and for on the right for space-like related pairs. And these are just for this specific value of the maximum value of this time coordinate. And one interesting thing to note is that going from the lower curves to the upper curves, we're going from the massive case to the massless case, and there's nothing funny or singular happening as we're going to the massless theory. So our Whiteman functions and vacua are well-defined both for the massive theory and the massless theory. And in particular, none of these curves correspond to the known alpha vacua in Disseter spacetime. They are a different, or each curve is a different Disseter invariant vacuum.
Small technical question. In that second plot where it's space-like, is that geodesic distance, or is that I think they call it Z or whatever, that serves as a proxy for geodesic distance?
Yeah, yeah.
And which is well-defined, even
yeah.
when geodesic distance is not well-defined.
Yeah.
So it's that Z?
Yes.
Okay.
Do you know what happens, like, what happens to this state in the state, and what happens to the Minkowski space limit? Lambda going to zero.
You mean how we studied in Minkowski space-time? Yeah,
no,
so...
No. This, and then taking the limit, this is another limit that Raphael was talking about in some ways. You're talking about space-time volume going to infinity, and I'm talking about lambda going to zero limit. Do you get Minkowski vacuum, or do you get some other vacuum?
This
vacuum does go to Minkowski
right.
vacuum, so I don't know what happens to this one.
We haven't looked at that, but...
We just fix the... Disseter radius and looked at this.
I mean, another thing we could do in this case is just zoom into a really small region and see if locally it looks like Minkowski. Haven't done that.
But we have looked at just Minkowski vacuum
right.
in 4D. Mm-hmm. And there, if you do it in a finite space, but you look in the, you do recover the Minkowski vacuum. So the SJ vacuum does give it to you when the boundary of the diamond is very far away.
I thought you said you were restricting to the positive eigenvalues of W, but here on the left plot, W is negative.
So these aren't the eigenvalues plotted. So when you do this, the sum over the positive part of I delta. Now, these values aren't in the eigenfunction space of I delta. They're just in real space.
I think he's asking that the vertical axis, the real part of W, are you asking that the real part of W can go negative?
Yeah.
Is that the question?
Right, that's allowed, as long as the eigenvalues are. The eigenvalues will be positive.
It's just like saying a matrix can have some negative entries and still be a positive definite matrix.
But there might actually be something interesting here about how there is some transition from positive to negative values. We haven't looked into that very much, but there is a transition. Okay, now let me shift to talking about entanglement entropy. So one of the main motivations of researchers in quantum gravity to think about entanglement entropy is this question of black hole entropy and whether or not all of it or most of it is entanglement entropy. The earliest conjecture that this might be the case is due to Raphael here, 1983. Many others have thought about this as well, but we still don't have a final answer to this important open question. Now, black holes are very global objects. We need to know the entire causal structure of the space-time to be able to say there's a black hole present, and we can't identify it at a moment in time. So since we're interested in studying its entropy, it would be good to have a space-time framework for studying this. And before I tell you about such a space-time framework, let me review the conventional way of defining entanglement entropy and give a little more motivation for having a space-time framework. So this is the conventional definition of entanglement entropy. We have minus trace rho log rho, where rho is a density matrix, typically on a hypersurface sigma. And if we divide sigma into two complementary regions, region A and region B, for example, in this diagram, and if we then for some reason don't have access to the quantum field degrees of freedom in one of these two regions, we obtain a reduced density matrix associated to either the region we don't have access to or its complement. By tracing out the degrees of freedom in one of the subregions, it doesn't matter which one we do because it's capturing entanglement. So both regions lack the same entanglement information. But for example, if we trace out the degrees of freedom in region B, we end up with a density matrix associated to region A. If we plug it back into here, we get an entropy that is identified as the entanglement entropy between region A and region B if the original density matrix was pure. And if we go ahead and compute this entanglement entropy in ordinary quantum field theory that's not regularized, we would get an infinite answer because we're including contributions to the entanglement of arbitrarily UV components of the quantum field. And these lead to infinite entanglement entropy. So we need to put a UV cutoff in order to get a finite answer. And in pictures such as this, the way we normally do it is we impose a UV cutoff that is often spatial in character. So it would be something like a minimum distance between region A and region B. And then we would get a finite answer. But as I just said, that would be a spatial cutoff. And ideally, we want to move away from using spatial quantities and calculations and work with covariant space-time ones, especially since our notion of entanglement entropy so strongly depends on a definition of UV cutoff. So we want to have a covariant definition to be able to trust what we're learning about entanglement entropy in general situations. And I already mentioned why in the black hole case, it would be important to have a space-time formulation. Some other reasons to seek a space-time definition of entanglement entropy are that quantum fields are in general too singular to always admit meaningful restrictions to hypersurfaces. I'll say a bit more about that in the next slide. And a notion of quantities on spatial slices is likely to become even more ambiguous in the context of quantum gravity, where we expect causal structure to fluctuate. And for those of us who are interested in studying entanglement entropy in causal set theory, even if we wanted to study it in the conventional spatial way, we couldn't, because there is no meaningful notion of a state on a hypersurface in causal sets. We need to have a more space-time framework for studying entanglement entropy. So here is an illustration of how a quantum field can be singular if we only describe it in a spatial domain. For example, let's consider the normal ordered phi square operator and smear it with a test function with compact support at a t constant spatial slice here. Now let's square this operator and compute its expectation value in the Minkowski vacuum. This is like looking at the variance of this operator. And we end up with an expression that diverges linearly in the K integral. Now, if we do the same thing, but instead smear with a test function with compact support in a region of space-time, we get enough suppression of the k-integral to get a finite answer. I'm not showing that calculation here, but you'll have to trust me on that. And you can repeat this exercise with other operators, such as the stress tensor and generic other nonlinear operators. So it seems to be that these nonlinear operators live more happily in regions of space-time. So hopefully you're somewhat convinced that it's a good idea to have a space-time definition of entropy. And here is a space-time definition of entropy. For details and a proof, I'll refer you to this paper. I'll just state the definition. So we have the familiar W and delta again. And the entropy is defined to be this sum over the solution's lambda to this generalized eigenvalue problem involving W and delta. And we exclude functions in the kernel of delta. Now, this W and delta are both space-time functions. So we can restrict them to, for example, a sub-volume of space-time within a larger volume of space-time that they are defined. And then
so where is V living? Is it a compactly supported function in some region? Who is V?
So V is in the image of delta.
V is in the image of delta.
Or, well, no, it's not the entire image of delta, but it's composed of bits in the image of delta.
So V is not compactly supported? That doesn't matter.
Well, depends in the, so again, this is an eigenvalue problem in a region of space-time. You can have a compact region of space-time, which is...
No, I'm just objecting to the fact that, I mean, on space-time, delta wouldn't be well-defined on things that are not compactly supported. So yes. I'm a bit confused, what's V?
It is compactly.
V is compactly supported, but then it cannot be in the image of delta. So you must mean something else.
I don't.
It,
I mean,
delta is
your style.
If delta is the Pauli Jordan, it propagates the support, right? So if you fit in something compactly supported, then you get something which is clearly not compactly supported.
As an integral operator,
is it
an integral? It's an integral operator. So it's
integrated. I don't believe that V is in the image of delta. Okay.
Okay, so we understand what is delta.
I mean,
delta?
If
you're mainly doing this for a compact region.
Right, but I, I'm I'm not sure, but because let's say we have no entanglement entropy and we just have one region.
Yeah.
Then, and let's say we sub in the SJ Whiteman function here, then we will get lambda solutions that are zeros and ones precisely because these V solutions will be the eigenfunctions of delta.
Your worries were not a non-compact space-time, right?
My worry, okay, I don't quite.
So I
would think that W is I have delta plus a symmetric pot.
Yeah.
Okay, so this means that these V's are in the kernel of the symmetric pot. Is that right? I mean, from that
mm-hmm.
equation.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So I would think that they're in the image, maybe. I mean, surely if they're image of the equation of motion operator, then
yeah.
But then both sides are
sure.
zero, so this is all fine, right?
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, I just okay.
Okay.
I don't see what
sure.
what these V's are.
Oh, I think Abhay had a question.
No.
Yeah.
I'm agreeing.
Yeah, I mean, I have to think about it. Maybe they're not in the image and they're just not in the kernel, but the equation nevertheless is well defined because
it's defined as long as you define the
correct space. It's just interpreting
space.
Where the solutions
yes.
yeah, are
yes.
living, sure. Right. Okay. Right. So here's just the quick application of this space-time definition of entanglement entropy in a causal set. So here we have a smaller causal diamond causal set nested within a larger one. So in the usual spatial case, one would be looking at the entanglement between the interval that's the diameter of this diamond and its complement in the larger region. But here we're looking at the full space-time causal set. And we know, so again, our delta is the difference between the retarded Green function and its transpose. And for the massless theory that my example here is, the retarded Green function in the causal set has a very simple form. It's just one half the causal matrix, where the causal matrix is a matrix where we put ones whenever two causal set elements are causally related to one another, and a zero otherwise, and we put zeros on the diagonal as well. For W, we take our SJ Whiteman function on this causal set, causal diamond, and this plot here in the black curve is the Minkowski two-point function in the presence of an infrared cutoff, and the blue scatter points are the SJ Whiteman function. Away from the boundaries, and what this plot is showing is that the two Whiteman functions agree. So you can interpret this SJ Whiteman function away from the boundaries as something analogous to the Minkowski vacuum with an infrared cutoff. And without going into the details, so the two-dimensional massless theory is infrared divergence.
Yeah.
You need.
But the cutoff is not going to be logarithmic, right? So. Okay, but let's.
Well.
How are they agreeing? Right.
Okay. Yeah. We can discuss that. But that's yeah. That's an.
Yeah, we can discuss. We come back to that.
Yeah. So here's the final answer for how the entropy scales with the UV cutoff, which is a discreteness scale. The points are consistent with the best fit curve, or the points have a best fit curve, which is consistent with a logarithmic scaling with the cutoff with a coefficient of 1/3, which is the expected answer. It's the area law expectation in this one plus one dimensional example. So we're getting the usual answers, but with a UV cutoff using the space-time formalism in the causal set. And recently with Sumati and Noman, again, we've been studying this entanglement entropy in regions of a causal set approximated by de Sitter spacetime, which are bounded by various horizons, like illustrated in these figures. For example, the future horizon, past horizon, and the intersection of the two. And our preliminary results show that the space-time entanglement entropy also obeys an area law in these cases as well. I'm also working on extending this space-time entanglement entropy to hold for interacting theories. For example, with these collaborators, we've considered a non-Gaussian scalar theory with a density matrix that looks like this, with quartic corrections to the Gaussian density matrix. And we found, surprisingly, that to first order and perturbation theory, the same Gaussian entanglement entropy formula holds. So at least in the, at least primarily, the entanglement entropy seems to only care, or mostly care about the two-point function in this case as well, which is surprising. But it may be hinting to us that more generally, the entanglement entropy cares mostly about the two-point function. And if this did pan out, it would be an example of a physical insight that we've gained as a result of working in a space-time framework. I'll just.
Yeah, sorry.
I'm almost done. I'll also just mention a couple other things about the space-time entropy formula. It has broad applications beyond these typical partitions of the space-time that one considers in bipartite entanglement entropy. For example, one can use it to study entropy due to coarse graining or entropy due to partitions of a space-time where the Cauchy surface of the partition part doesn't necessarily lie within the Cauchy surface of the full region of space-time. It's just harder to interpret the answers in that case, but it can be studied. And also, because we have this covariant framework and a nice interpretation of the cutoff, we could potentially learn something about the magnitude of entanglement entropy in addition to its scaling with the cutoff. For example, if we are indeed counting the microscopic degrees of freedom of a system, for example, in the black hole case, then maybe we can look at the relative magnitude of the entanglement entropy in the black hole case with the cutoff set to the Planck scale relative to the entanglement entropy in the cosmological case with the cutoff set to the Planck scale, and compare that relative magnitude to the relative magnitude of the classical entropies. That may give us some evidence as to whether we are on the right track to understanding the microscopic degrees of freedom that describe those classical entropies. So I'll just summarize now. Maintaining explicit Lorentz invariance is hard, but progress has been made. Some of the things that I've talked about, I think, can help us understand some aspects of quantum field theories in a space-time domain that they more naturally live in. I told you about some ideas in causal set theory and entanglement entropy. And we have a lot more work to do. We would like to supplement our current understanding with similar understanding using other fields, more interactions, black hole entanglement entropy. And ultimately, it would be very nice if I could be talking about the Lorentzian path integral formulation of a lot of these quantities. But for now, this seems to be a step in that right direction. Thank you.
There were lots of questions that people wanted to ask, and I stopped them from asking. So please do ask your questions now.
Okay, so this result about the QWERTY perturbations, and you said it was also determined by the two-point function. Is there a way to relate this to the first law of entanglement entropy, where the first order change is supposed to be just the expectation value of the modular Hamiltonian of the unperturbed state?
I have no idea.
Okay.
I mean, I guess we don't necessarily have a Hamiltonian in these
cases, but this is just one. And so it's the first order perturbation is just the expectation value of that in the perturbed state. So just curious if you can see it.
Yeah, I was wondering, you don't have anything in principle against quantum fields living away. The one I mentioned was you just said they're unhappier, but I mean, usually we can live.
Right, I mean, sure. I mean, and it's possible that, I mean, it's possible that singularities like this don't matter at all. But if you do have a framework that doesn't have these problems, then why not? Kind of like, that's why I opened with Hiles's motivations. Like, there wasn't a specific problem or singularity he was trying to tackle. It's just, if you can have something that allows these same quantities to live in a space-time domain without giving up anything else.
And we are, of course, positively interested in, you know, describing something as a function of some arbitrary chosen time function. And then, of course, we need to have a there are reasons for why one would like such things. What you're saying is a causal set approach. There are some fundamental incompatibilities.
So one that I mentioned was that there is no meaningful notion of a state on a hypersurface. So we can't think in those terms. Even if you thicken it, there will be links that will not be detected by your thickened notion.
So there is some fundamental incompatibility.
Right, yes, yes. But I was trying to give reasons more general reasons. In causal set theory, there is a more fundamental reason to do things in a space-time way, but I was trying to include reasons one more generally might be interested in space-time frameworks.
I just wanted to comment, Renata's
yeah.
comment.
Okay. Maybe you can go ahead.
So just wanted to give another reason why fields are more happy in space-time. So if you're doing perturbation theory, if you do renormalization, then it's actually better to work with things that are not on the Cauchy surface but are in some sort of thickened Cauchy surface. So
is it related
actually,
to this?
It is related
yeah.
to this because you get extra singularities if you want to do like Hamiltonian formalism on the nose, so things localized in the Cauchy surface, you get the Stuckenberg sort of singularities. So that's why in perturbative algebraic quantum field theory, you also work in space-time regions which are like a thickened Cauchy surface rather than Cauchy surface. So it's very singular to kind of, you know, constrain your fields to dimension lower surface.
We are also happy in space-time, but I was really asking about, you know, is there some fundamental incompatibility?
Yeah.
And she said,
and that's,
yes.
That's, yeah, that's a different, yeah, that's,
so
that's
interesting.
Story.
What does it tell us? Does it tell us there's a deep insight that causes us heroes, or no?
I think everybody's going to be in the same.
We think so. That's going to have many different opinions, but let Abhay ask his question.
Yeah, I mean, just to continue our conversation about this subject. So, I mean, I'm agreeing with your statements up here, but on the other hand, I mean, there is a completely well-defined regularization of that operator, which will make all this finite, right? And we just do adiabatic regularization. I mean, it's not right to just take phi squared, take the normal order, and then take a power order of that. You should take phi to the fourth and then regularize it again. Or, I mean, phi squared, normal order is not a well-defined operator anyway. You can just talk about, probably talking about expectation value or something, or, you know, a dagger, okay.
But, I mean, even if you took the normal ordered phi to the fourth and you threw it into
I
guess,
that's
order.
Not right.
Yeah.
That's not right, good, right, regularization. There is a renormalization. One can, I mean, in the simple models that she's considering, because she's looking at free fields here. And for free fields, there is absolutely no problem in doing this.
Right, but I'm taking nonlinear terms.
Just as a response to what Renata was saying, and sometimes one wants to do it, and I don't think that is a fundamental problem. But on the other hand, I like everybody else in the room, yes. Space-time picture is much nicer. But my questions were small questions.
But just to comment on what you said, so you said in free theories there's no problems. So I'm taking nonlinear operators in the free theory, which would appear in an interacting theory perturbatively.
Sure.
So that,
still,
so it's a very generic.
Nonlinear problems in field theory can be regularized, in free field theory, can be regularized.
One would have to discuss each of those regularization schemes.
Exactly.
But this is just basic.
But it's not a problem of in principle. You do it in some way, then there's a problem. I agree. But there are better ways of doing it, in which case there's no problem. But anyway, this is another matter.
Okay.
So the quick clarifications I wanted were, in two-dimensional residual space, you said, well, your entropy is area, but it was two space-time dimensions.
One plus one.
So
the leading term
one
is a constant, but there's a subleading term which is a logarithm.
What does area mean? It's a point, right?
Right, that's why you have a constant.
I mean, in two dimensions, one plus one dimensions, you get the logarithmic law as the area law. That's
the area law is a
law. It's a
law,
yeah. It's an area law.
Okay.
That's the constant.
And the other was about
the massless case.
Yeah, about the massless case.
Massive is just the area. Constant.
And then the other question was about, I mean, I'm surprised by this equality you get for this, by putting the system in a box which evaluates Lorentz invariants, and your nice causal sets. I mean, one of the main motivations was to keep Lorentz invariants there, right?
Right.
So why are we...
But then we are, so...
So we should not...
There's a sense that we're going to run late, and we have an exciting discussion at 4:10, which we must all please be present for, because we're going to argue out all our various. There's going to be a lot of fighting, and as from an Indian perspective, it's going to be like Mahabharata war. But
4:20.
Okay, so we
can continue with the discussion.
Yes. So please continue, and let's thank Yasaman once again.